The Christmas story and the scenes thereof are, of course, very familiar to us, and they involve quite a number of characters. Every Epiphany, of course, we are reintroduced to the Magi. I thought that this Epiphany I might point out that the Christmas story as a whole comes to us from only two of the Gospels, those of Matthew. And we heard the Magi from his the second chapter of his gospel, and then from Luke, where, for example, we get the shepherds and other parts of the story. However, have you ever wondered how these various characters and places and times and events conjoin? I'm going to point out to you that there are some things that seem a bit confusing. And then do my best to answer the questions and demonstrate that actually everything may line up, but that might require us to set aside some preconceptions or assumptions that we have absorbed over time. Okay. So back to the Gospel of the Epiphany. Jesus is born in Bethlehem in the days of King Herod, and Magi from the east arrive in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn King of the Jews?" So firstly, who are these people, where have they come from, and why do they think that there is a new king who would have replaced Herod, requiring him to be dead? And Herod is, of course, not dead. Why does Herod take these people aside secretly and apart from others in order to learn from them the time of the appearance of what they describe as a star leading them to make the trek to Jerusalem? Okay. Then, seeing a bright light in the sky preceding them as they set out for Bethlehem, which incidentally is only 7 or 8 miles from Jerusalem, they enter the house and see the child with Mary, his mother. Well, wait a second. I thought that they were out in a stable. What about the manger? Where's the manger? We're in a house? Okay. It says that this star stops over the place where the child is, over this house. Well, what is that? They then, of course, bow down and give gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, who, as we know from the rest of Matthew's gospel, he is going to send a band of soldiers to kill all boys 2 years old, appearing 2 years old and younger. They depart for their country by another way. Where are the shepherds? And how is it that in St. Luke's gospel, Mary and Joseph are having Jesus presented to the Lord and circumcised as the firstborn Jewish male? And then we remember that the Lord warns Saint Joseph that Herod intends to kill Jesus, so take the family, flee to the land of Egypt. Okay, so they fled to the land of Egypt, they're in exile, but then they're back at the temple 40 days after the birth for the offering of the purification of Mary, the two turtle doves. Well, wait a second. You're back in Jerusalem. You don't seem too terribly afraid of a murderous king who wants to kill your son. And I thought that you were in exile in Egypt. And if you were in exile in Egypt, how are you providing for yourselves since you're not Arabs and Joseph is the provider for the family? And that was back in Nazareth, and they did not think that they would have to be going into exile, since their only reason for being in Bethlehem in the first place was for the tax census. How do you make sense of all of these things? All right. Well, I'm going to share with you my theory, which I am not proposing as absolutely true, but I think does make sense, and is based upon my study of some of these matters. Also, of a documentary that I watched some years ago have shared here at the parish, incidentally. Maybe it was even last Epiphany we showed it. It was put together by a Protestant gentleman who was intrigued by similar questions, especially focused upon what the lights in the sky were that led these Magi to Jerusalem. And if you are interested in the precise details of that, he has put all of the data from his documentary on a website that is BethlehemStar.com. Check it out maybe later today. All right. So, first of all, who are these people, the Magi? Well, they are almost certainly Persians, that is, from the modern-day nation of Iran. They are pagans. They are Zoroastrians, followers of the religion of Zoroaster. And they are astrologers, not astronomers, astrologers. So signs of the zodiac, horoscopes, all of those kind of things that we Christians should not have anything to do with. That's ancient Persian paganism. Okay, but nevertheless, that was their religion, and they were very good, and they were very precise in figuring out the movements of these celestial bodies, the planets, and the stars. And they assigned symbolic meaning and value to constellations, planets, etc. So this man who did the Star of Bethlehem project took software, which has only existed very recently, and allows a person to turn back the clock, so to speak, in the night sky and place oneself anywhere on the planet that one wishes and say, I want to see what the night sky looked like on the 4th of July, 1776. You can do that. You can be in Philadelphia. Look up. That's what it looked like. This is brand new technology. So what he did was he just went back to the Bethlehem, Jerusalem area and rewound the clock and watched over and over, was there anything occurring in the sky around the year 1 or a few years before or a few years after that would be unusual and potentially symbolic to the Persians. And he found a few things. He found that in September of 3 BC, there was a very unusual phenomenon whereby the king planet, Jupiter, had the star Regulus very close to it with the backdrop of the constellation Leo, which means lion, and of all of the 12 tribes of Israel, the tribe of Judah, the Jewish tribe, was described as the lion tribe. You remember the prophecy, you are like a lion crouching, etc. Okay. So they might have thought, well, we see king symbolism, we see potentially Jew symbolism, but then there would have been more. 9 months later, in I guess that would have been June of 2 BC, they would have seen the brightest light in the night sky, except for the moon, of course, that they had ever seen, when the planets Venus and Jupiter conjoined such that they would have been indistinguishable to the naked eye and would have created an extraordinarily bright light. He proposes that that corresponds with our Lord's birth. Thus, and there are many, many other very interesting phenomena that he points out on his website. I didn't memorize them all, okay. But they would have seen something in the night sky corresponding with Jesus' conception, and then something else, the reappearance of the great light in the sky corresponding with his birth. And that also helps to explain why Herod ascertains from them secretly because he's about to do something murderous, the time of the star's appearance. Herod does not know whether this would have corresponded with the birth or the conception. He doesn't care. He is near the end of his life. He is in horrifically declining health, we know from history at this point. He is also paranoid, so paranoid that he begins to murder members of his own family because he's afraid that they are trying to take power from him, leading Caesar Augustus to comment it was better to be Herod's pig than his son. So the idea that he would send a small band of soldiers a few miles to a small village to kill any male 2 years and younger is entirely in concert with what we know of his character, but also it demonstrates that he says, I'm not going to take any chances, and I'm not going to trust soldiers to be able to have sophisticated understanding of the ages of babies, so just you see a child, looks about two or younger, kill it, that will cover all bases. All right? So, these magi see things in the night sky that correspond with the symbolism that they have already themselves applied to it, leading them to the conclusion, Herod has died, there is a new king, so let's set out and honor him. Of course, they arrive in Jerusalem. Herod's very much alive still, though not with long to live. Okay. And I would put the timeline of this and the other events thus. Joseph and Mary have to, for the census tax enrollment, travel to Bethlehem. She is very, very pregnant and about to give birth. They arrive. This village of only a few hundred people is completely swollen, and there's no room for them anywhere. Thus, they have to lodge with the animals, which would not be a stable constructed of wood, almost certainly, since in the Bethlehem area there are very large limestone caves, and the people then would have almost certainly use those caves for the animals rather than wasting wood constructing buildings for the animals. So Jesus was almost certainly born in a cave. I have visited Bethlehem, and you can go into these caves and imagine the scene. All right. So he is born in a cave. He is placed in the manger there for one of the animals, and the shepherds come. And they encounter our Lord in that context, in the manger. But then it says that the magi go to a house. I think that this is easily interpreted as, in a small village, once the word gets out that there is a poor girl who's just given birth out with the animals in the cave, certainly someone would have given up his or her room to allow them to move into a house. Start out in the cave with the animals, the manger, but then probably soon thereafter received into some lodging, and probably the census is ending and people are leaving anyway, leaving Bethlehem and going back home. Mary and Joseph, though, do not go back home because Jesus is the firstborn male child, so they need to have him dedicated to the Lord 8 days after his birth and circumcised. So they lodge in Bethlehem in the house. They go to the temple. He is dedicated. He is circumcised. They return to Bethlehem. I propose that it is approximately at this point that the Magi arrive, have their audience with King Herod. He sends them to Bethlehem. They see the rising behind Bethlehem relative to Jerusalem, their starting point, the conjoining of the planets of Venus and Jupiter, the brightest light that they had ever seen before. They had not seen anything in the night sky so phenomenal since 9 months or 10 months prior, right? So they are overjoyed. They're thrilled. This seems to be the same thing, even if, according to this proposal, it's not precisely the same thing, but it is a bright light. All right, so they head out towards Bethlehem. It is over Bethlehem. They have to walk 7 or 8 miles. That takes some hours. Meanwhile, those conjoined planets, that single light rises until by the time they get to Bethlehem, it's overhead. But that won't get you to any particular address. Let's just point out the obvious. If any of you said, where is Deacon Thompson's house? And I said, just go to Manhattan. It's directly under the moon. You would say, what? Okay, same thing. If I said, go to Bethlehem, the house will be under the star, that makes no sense. Which means, of course, it is possible that this was a miraculous light that hovered only, would have had to be only feet over the house. I am interpreting this as not being such a thing, but would explain it in this way. They are told to go to Bethlehem. All right, we know how to get to Bethlehem. There's only a few hundred people there. Easy. Okay? We see a light over Bethlehem and it's rising. We're thrilled. But that's not necessarily getting us to the house. All that they would have needed to do is arrive in this little village as a large, exotic-looking group of Persians. And certainly someone would have said, may I help you? Or, who are you and what are you doing here? And all they would have said is, we are looking for a newborn male child. And in such a small village, it's entirely possible that somebody would say, oh, I know exactly where there is one that has just been born. It's that house right there. Okay, which I think is consistent with the scriptures. Light overhead, but probably directed by humans to the house, which they enter and encounter the child Jesus and Mary. All right. Now, then they, after giving their gifts and bowing down, are warned in a dream not to go back to Herod and leave for Persia by a different route, which implies that this group of men, which probably numbered more than three, though they are often represented in art and in our imaginations as three because the gifts are three. It's probably a pretty large group of Persians. Okay, they're warned in a dream not to return to Herod. This implies that these men all had the same dream the same night. Think of that. Okay? Such that they wake up and one says, I had the wildest dream. The other one says, I had the same dream. And then all 11 of them go, we all had the same dream? Probably a good idea to follow its guidance then. Let's get out of here. And so now they're gone and completely out of the Christmas story. Then God warned Saint Joseph, also in a dream, of Herod's intention to murder the child, and says, flee with the child and its mother to Egypt. Okay, again, back to art and popular imagination. Have you ever seen a depiction of the Holy Family in Egypt? I have. I think I saw one where Mary is sleeping on the Sphinx, you know, with the great pyramids in the background. Well, of course, when one thinks of Egypt, one thinks of the pyramids and the Sphinx. However, this is quite unrealistic because Egypt is a very large region and it borders the Holy Land, Israel. And so all that the Holy Family would have needed to do is escape out of Herod's territory, Jewish territory, into Arabian territory and take refuge in a nearby town or a village. They wouldn't have had to go all the way to Giza. Okay? Probably never saw the pyramids or the Sphinx, and that's just fine. But now, Joseph hadn't planned for this. He's not an Arab. He's a Jew. He's out of place and has no work. How are they going to provide for themselves? Anybody know? He's rich. He just had a band of Persians show up and give him gold. And what kind of gold did he receive? Nuggets out of a stream in Montana? No. A bag of dust? No. How about a bar? No. What is the form of gold at that time? Coins. Cold, hard cash, people. Okay? And there is no more universally exchangeable form of currency than gold coins. Thus, I think we could say with confidence that the Arabs were more than happy to put the Holy Family up and feed them as long as Joseph kept paying out. And I'm guessing that he was quite capable to do that, which indicates that this gift of gold, which is, of course, theologically, symbolically important, nevertheless had a very practical purpose. The Lord knew that Joseph was going to be in exile and out of work, providing for the Holy Family. So how long were they there? Years? Well, again, we are told by St. Luke that they're back at the temple only 40 days after Jesus' birth, at the end of Mary's period of ritual purification. They make the offering of poor people, right? And then it says they return to Nazareth. Well, it doesn't seem that they're afraid of a murderous king. What's going on? Well, I think this is explained fairly simply, that they were only in exile in Egypt for a few weeks. And Herod, already at this point quite old and in terribly deteriorated health, dies in that few week period. Joseph receives word of the death and the guidance, you can go back now. So they're there a short time. Did they spend all the gold? We don't know. Doesn't really matter. But they wouldn't have had to be there for years. And so then they return to Jerusalem. They go to the temple, make the offering, and then all is well, and they can return to Galilee and to Nazareth. So I hope that all makes sense. If I missed anything after Mass, please tell me. I'd love to know. Or if there are other questions in your mind, things that didn't seem to align or that you wondered about. But what is the point of all of that? Well, the point is this, people. If you ever make it onto Jeopardy and one of the squares up there says Christmas trivia, pick it. Because now you can be a winner.